Okay, everyone.
Well, fishes, my fishes. Welcome back to Prison Breaking with Sarah and Paul. I'm Sarah.
And I'm Paul.
And we are recording our first episode back from the holiday break. Refreshed. So grateful for a rest. I don't know about the rest of you guys, but 2023 rang me out.
Yep, same, same, same. Ready for 2024, though, feeling refreshed and grateful, as they say. Today's episode is called Sleight of Hand. We have new characters introduced. We have a double delicious plot twist, one of my favorite plot twists.
We have a broken finger.
A broken finger. Is that part of the double entendre of Sleight of Hand, do you think?
I don't know. But I wrote that in our script, and you sold that very well. It's a very stupid thing to say. You're wondering.
No, I wonder if it was part of the...
It might be. Your hand is slightly broken. We will find out as we discuss the episode. But first, our Calistine Index. This episode first aired November 7th of 2005, which is now 19 years ago since it's 2024. It was written really, really well by Nick Santora, directed beautifully by Dwight Little. This episode impressed me so much. The rating was 8.06 million viewers. Our lead-in this week turned out to be Arrested Development, which is unusual, I believe, and a bit of a gear change. Competition in the time slot were our usual suspects, Monday Night Football and ABC. Colts-Patriots, final score was 40-21. And as somebody who knows nothing about football, that still sounds terrible to me.
Ass-kicking, yeah.
Sorry, Pats. 2.5 Men was on CBS and Las Vegas was on NBC.
The episode in brief, Michael and Sarah get closer after he saves her. Inmate Franklin works in the guardroom repairs and finds the escape hole. That's C-note. Michael tells Abrucci's boss how he found the witness. Falzone goes to kill the witness. However, it's a false address. Michael and Abrucci were working together to have Falzone and his men arrested. That's the big twist. Michael returns to work in the guardroom, now forced to include C-note. And Vice President Reynolds informs Agent Kellerman that the company has sent its own operative, Quinn, to take over their work.
And to orient us in pop culture, in November of 2005, the movie version of Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire premiered on November 6th. That's the first book in the series and the movie. It went on to make $896 million. Which I suppose is not surprising. I did love those books.
It could have failed.
I suppose it could have failed. And I believe that was directed by Christopher Columbus. And
it was, in fact, directed by Chris Columbus.
First, do you know, I have it on VHS.
Wow.
It's that long ago. I know. All right. November 8th that week, this was a big week, George R.R. Martin's fourth book in his series, A Song of Ice and Fire, was released in the U.S., the book was titled Feast of Crows. It reached the New York Times bestseller list, which actually made it, and this was interesting as I was doing our research, only the third fantasy writer ever to achieve that.
Wow, that's surprising.
One of the others was Neil Gaiman. That book would become the basis for the fifth season of HBO's Game of Thrones. And the next day in this giant week, on November 9th, Madonna, a little-known pop artist, released her 10th studio album, the disco/electropop influenced Confessions of a Dance Floor. And if I'm perfectly honest, my confession is it is not my favorite Madonna album.
In global events, on November 6th, Saddam Hussein's defense lawyer is assassinated a day after he predicted he would be murdered. Wow, that's dark. On November 7th, China closed Beijing poultry markets and seized chickens and ducks from private homes as the government wrapped up its fight against the bird flu there. And in good news, Sierra Leone eradicated polio in the country thanks to a successful immunization campaign there.
And on that bright spot in global health, eradicating global diseases, this is our rewatch. You guys ready?
I would like to point out Wentworth's awesome Widow's Peak.
Mm-hmm. He's got a really good hairline.
Yeah, it's just great hair all around. I feel like we're this kind of similar characters, Quinn and Kellerman.
Yeah, there's a lot of overlap in the way they're sort of articulated, isn't there?
Mm-hmm.
And yet it doesn't feel that way.
That's why I was like, huh, I wonder if this guy's going to take my job.
There's another twist. I forgot all about this. That word, bulls, was Rob Nepper's only line in that entire episode.
Wow.
I'll tell you a story about it in the podcast. We had a conversation about it. Thank you for that rewatch, folks. And we will be right back to talk about the episode.
We are back, folks. Okay, some additional topics that we want to discuss in this episode of our podcast. Stage direction. And how actors respond to stage directions, which is the kind of stuff around in the script that's not the dialogue. Sometimes there's very little stage directions. Sometimes there's a lot.
Okay, right. I wanted to talk to you about this because I actually went through my script for this episode. And I noticed in your scene with Quinn, and we have a lot to talk about with the scene with Quinn. But you have a line that you say to Hale before Quinn arrives. You say, I hear you talk like that again. I'm going to put a bullet between your eyes. The stage direction for that line says, quote, Kellerman delivers the next line nonchalantly, comma, an empty threat between friends. And after the line, it says, Kellerman rolls his neck. So my question is, like, how do you feel about stage directions with that kind of specificity?
I feel like stage directions, as I've worked more and more, I feel like a lot of times, and being on the other side, a lot of times they are for the network and they should actually be removed to be given to the actors because they can be confusing sometimes. To make things incredibly clear about how something is going to play, sometimes the writers will put things in so the network doesn't say, Kellerman seems awfully hostile towards Hale right now. And he says, no, it's said in a nonchalant way. I'm not saying that's the case in this particular stage direction. I will say that.
But they're kind of tone notes.
That's well said. They're kind of tone notes rather than this is how you need to act it. Although sometimes that serves the same. I think that I used to take them too seriously. Some actors just cross them out. I do think it's important information. I think Kellerman delivers the next line nonchalantly, an empty threat between friends. I think nonchalantly is the thing I took from that. An empty threat, it's not an empty threat. There's an innuendo there, which you're not, and obviously, the music cue is like, with a rattle. I don't know if that answers your question, but.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, listen, I remember hearing somewhere, and this could be totally apocryphal, that Chris Walken, the first thing he does when he gets a script is take a Sharpie and cross out, like obliterate all of the stage directions. And I think it's interesting because I have often thought, like you just said, that it would be great if once the studio and network get their drafts, they do an actor's draft where they take out most of those stage directions, just because I think there are some actors who second guess their own instincts when they see the stage direction. And my least favorite stage direction that I've ever that ever shows up that makes it virtually impossible to do a scene is, and then your character cries, right? Like it's a result note that almost always makes it super hard for an actor to
cry. First of all,
to cry. Yeah. Anyway, I just wanted your two cents on it as a.
I think that also it's important to any actors out there, anybody, frankly, that it's funny or ironic or something that stage direction is a bit of a misnomer here. In theater, a stage direction is where you go. Downstage left, picks up a cup. It's literally actions. It's very rarely acting tone notes.
Oh, that's interesting, isn't it?
In film and TV, there are action lines, right? Like, you know, the the day is very dark and they can't see and there's smoke in the room and he searches for the gun.
They pull up in a car and get out.
Yeah, right. And all the action stuff. And then there are stage directions, which sometimes are parentheses under a line, which says like warmly or without anger or stuff like that, which can be helpful for what's intended. But the fact that we call it stage directions, I think means that a lot of people that started on stage treat it like, you know, sacrosanct.
Right.
Because that's where every single word counts in theater and you're supposed to honor every single thing.
As though TV it's Chekhov saying,
right.
I need you to do this on this line or the play falls apart. That's such a good point. Yeah.
And I think that takes time to get over. Not that you want to disregard, but you have to take it into account. I mean, what I read when I say, when I see Kellerman delivers the next line nonchalantly as empty threats between friends is it's not an overt threat.
Right.
You know, it's like he's not getting in his face, but it's, you know, that that's all I took that to mean. And then Kellerman rolls his neck, which I think, if it, unless it was really specific to the scene, that kind of physical stage direction can be frustrating for an actor, especially if you've been playing the character for a while. That feels like a reference to the thing I did in an earlier scene where I actually cracked my neck, which was something I did after the take that they really liked and kept in. So then it became a thing that Kellerman started doing. And so that I think Nick just liked that.
Do that thing you do.
I don't even know if I did it, but yeah.
And I was watching, like, you didn't, but it's not like the scene suffered for it.
I kind of like shrug my shoulders or something, but I think that what that's saying is, you know, Kellerman does a Kellerman thing, which is, you know, fine.
Kellerman's.
We had some new characters introduced we wanted to talk about, right? Michael Gaston shows up to play Quinn. We were joking about it during the rewatch. It's always scary when, if you're playing a character like Kellerman and they bring somebody in who's kind of more Kellerman-y than Kellerman, you say, oh, am I getting fired? It's fun, which is great because, not great, it's scary, but it's funny because the dynamic between the characters is also the dynamic between like the actors. You're like, is this person here to kill me? And Kellerman is like, is this person here to kill me? You know? You're like, oh, is this person taking my spot? It's actually a mirror dynamic, which is funny. The thing I want to talk about was, I guess you say, and you're right, it's the first time we hear of the company. And then Kellerman goes to Vice President Reynolds and says, you brought these guys in. This is bad news. They're bad news. You know, they're introducing this idea of somebody even higher up pulling the strings.
Right.
In terms of Kellerman and Vice President Reynolds, it's interesting. What Prison Break does so well with all the characters is they constantly shift power dynamics. So suddenly they are being threatened. And not just by Vice President Reynolds is saying, you're screwing this up, I'm going to fire you. Suddenly there's someone saying, we're going to kill you. And what that...
Which is the Fowl's Moan Abruzzi dynamic. You know,
that's right. And what you see then is, like, it makes Abruzzi do, and what you're going to see with Kellerman and Hale is it makes them go off the plan. It makes them makes them improvise. It makes them do things out of character and go rogue. And so that is, you know, that keeps happening in Prison Break, is you have A trying to get to B, and there's going to be all these side paths that you have to take to get there. And that's really fun writing. And it's fun to watch somebody like Kellerman and Hale, who have been really kind of, I mean, they've screwed up a couple things or a couple things have gone wrong, but like they're kind of untouchable.
Yeah, they've been ghosts. They're
quite touchable.
Yeah, it's true, you know, because it goes from Michael has power to nope, Bellick takes the power to nope, the Pope takes the power to nope, the governor takes the power.
That's right.
To, you know, I mean, and I think the challenge in the writing, and the way they handled it with Fibonacci, Falzone, Abruzzi, and Michael, I think is very deft. The danger is you just have to keep escalating up and up and up and up, and it gets ridiculous. And so to find ways of readjusting back down of, okay, we've now eliminated Falzone. The power is now back with Abruzzi, centered back on Michael. This kind of resetting, I think, is very clever. By the way, just before we come off that, this is an odd thing, but it just made me think about it, this constant dance of status. I remember being told in grad school, how do you know that the person on stage is the queen? It's not because she stands. It's because when she sits, everyone else stands. Meaning that you can't take status. Status can only be given. And I think it's, you know, Quinn has power, not because Quinn shows up and is ferocious, but because of the way that Kellerman and Hale behave when Quinn is in the room. And I think it's an interesting thing for actors, because I've seen actors, when they get insecure, refuse to give up status. All of a sudden you have a scene that doesn't work because you're like, buddy, you're not in charge here. This guy's in charge.
This could be a whole nother podcast. You hear stories in, especially about movie stars, after a certain period where they're like, well, I'm not doing that.
Right.
Like, I'm not getting on my knees, or I'm not going
to make me look weak.
It'll make me look Chris. I was on a show with somebody who will remain nameless, who wouldn't wear certain color, I don't want to give anything away, costume.
Okay.
Because it was not masculine. And he said, my fan base doesn't want to see me in this.
Oh, interesting. Right.
That's kind of an extreme version of it. But also, I would say the writing with Quinn is really fun and great, because he does this whole, you know, he's like described as kind of his tie's undone and he's sloppy and he's like kind of the opposite of the buttoned down military vibe that Kellerman and Hale have.
Yeah. When he says to Sebastian, I'm an insurance adjuster, you're like, yep.
Yeah. You buy that.
That tracks. Right.
Like, innocuous.
Oh, and I do want to answer a question for those of us who are coming from the watch party. Michael Gaston, in fact, was not in Walking Dead, but he has been in approximately everything else on TV. I just looked through his IMDb resume and I was like, oh, you're the hardest working actor in Hollywood.
He's never stopped working.
And he's fantastic.
And he's fantastic. And we have some great stuff coming up. Also, we were introduced to Nika, whose intro reads from your script, camera slowly reveals a woman primping at a vanity. Hashtag male gaze. Something elegant in the way she puts on lipstick. She's perhaps the hottest Eastern European woman this side of Prague.
And I got to say, I read that.
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, the Nika of it all, I think, is brilliant. Holly Valance did a wonderful job playing
Holly
her.
Valance. Right, yeah.
Yeah, who was like a huge pop star at the time. I remember
really?
She had some, she had like a huge hit single in, I think, the UK.
Is she, I'm embarrassed to ask, is she Czech?
She is, in fact, I believe, Australian. She was doing an accent. But I got to say, I was going through my script and I was like, perhaps the hottest Eastern European woman this side of Prague. I was wondering what's happening on the other side of Prague.
It's
making Nika Volek not
on the
hottest
side,
woman.
More on the west side. Oh, right. It's super east of Prague.
I want fans to answer this question for us. I want to do a little competition. What are things happening on the other side of Prague that make Nika Volek not the hottest Eastern European woman over there? Send us your answers, fans. Best answer wins a prison breaking merch mug. Okay, something that I think you did really, really well, going back to that scene, acting pain, physical pain. Of all the things that we do as actors, I sometimes find it the eggiest thing to do, meaning you feel like you have egg all over your face. Because I think so much of the way we behave when we're in a ton of pain is absurd and not something anybody necessarily wants to see on TV. But also we're very rarely observing it in ourselves. You know, like there are times when you're in grief or in love or whatever, where that actor part of you is outside going, oh, I could use this. I sort of see this. But usually when at least I'm in pain, like if I get hit in the head, I just burst into tears. And I thought you did a great job. And I wondered if you had any specific feelings about, you know, this is a show where you shot and beat up and broken.
Yeah. I also have trouble playing that sometimes and not, you know, the thing that they always tell an actor to do is don't play the obstacle. So you always want to play, mm-hmm. if you're drunk, you always want to play that you're trying not to appear drunk, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, although sometimes you just,
I'm so sober,
that one. Sometimes, because sometimes when you're drunk, you just want, you don't care if somebody knows you're drunk. So yeah. Anyway, it depends on the scene. In this particular scene, two things I remember keeping in mind that were super helpful to the how people are going to know how much pain I'm in thing, which is one, Kellerman is so trained. He's a Navy SEAL, Secret Service. He has probably a relationship with pain that he can, you know, mask it.
Shut it off.
And yeah, or, you know, at least not let it out. And that's one. And two is that while Quinn is in that room, he's not going to show him how much pain he's in. And basically, I was just like, let's see if how long I can hold my breath. I mean, it was, I think that's what I did. I mean, it was just like, how do you not scream?
Right.
I kind of put my face in the carpet and screamed a little bit. And they used the right takes to make it, you know, just look, I think, like I was trying to keep it inside. That was the only thing I thought about.
You know, and I don't know if this was scripted or not. I can't remember, but I love the moment where Hale takes a couple steps forward and you're like, nope.
Yeah, yeah. And I put my hand, I know, yes. Which is, I don't remember if that was scripted or not. I don't remember.
I can tell
I love it. I love when they keep stuff like that, though, because there's a whole story in that, right? Because I'm saying, we got to let this guy do his thing. Like, we're ceding power at that moment.
Right.
Totally ceding power. Lost his battle. It was a very fun scene to play. So there was a revision to the second Michael Cera scene in your script. The original lines, right? There was a Snow White and the Seven Dwarves joke.
Yeah. So I was going through it. So in the second scene between Michael and Sarah, I think this is one of the ones that I want to say Wentworth had a few ideas on. I'm not sure what was and what wasn't. So this is the production draft dated 9/23. And then what's in the collated green draft was 9/30, meaning, I think we actually went back to some of the original lines. I love when Michael says you ought to have a little more faith in the world. And Sarah says this coming from an eight-toed guy locked up in a penitentiary. I love that. And I think we went back to that in the green pages. Michael says, what about optimism, hope, the possibility that things might just work out? Sarah says, happily ever after. Look around, Michael. This isn't a fairy tale. Michael then says, then what are those seven dwarves doing out there in the hall? Sarah tries to hide a smile. Michael says, that smile, it suits you. Shame you don't use it more often. This is all kind of minutia, but I like that they took, I don't know. I like the seven dwarves joke, but I like the version that we ended up shooting and using. And
do you remember shooting the seven dwarves version too? Or
No, I don't. We did.
You didn't. Okay.
I don't think we did. Something that I think a lot of actors learn early on is when they say, well, just give us a version in case we need to use it. That's always the version they'll use. So if it needs to be a conversation, make it a conversation. It's interesting because I think there's only two scenes between Michael and Sarah in this episode, but it feels like they go a long way together.
It's great because there's an arc to it. She starts there's a pretty hard stiff arm up to him at the beginning. And by the end, it's the rose. And she says, thank you for trying to get me to smile today. And he says, well, you never know. And then she does smile, even though he's not there to receive it. It's very nice. And I know that you commented that the thing with the flower is one of the most remixed scenes of Michael and Sarah, like used in YouTube videos and whatnot. Is that right?
I think that flower took on a big significance. He gives it to her, I think, again in season 4. It comes up again in season 5. I don't know. There's just something that Wendt and I talked about a lot was the The relationship lives in the restraint. It lives in everything that isn't said. And these scenes are interesting because for the first time, he's trying to get more out of her than she's trying to get out of him. Right? It's always been, talk to me, tell me what's going on. Mm. Who are you? And this time it's, why are you sad? And what's happy birthday? And why are you bummed about that? It also in the original script said I was 27, and I think we landed on 29 because we did the math on medical school residency.
Going to medical school at 16.
Exactly. Doogie Howser is Dr. Tancredi in.
I think that's an interesting dynamic you talk about, is that what has switched is after he rescues her is that he's kind of warmed to her now. And she's, because she let him in a little bit, it feels like it freaked her out and she's shut that door. And now the dynamic has changed.
Yeah, and he needs her for this. Like, I think in some ways what starts in these scenes is the dynamic of the audience going, how much of this is he needs her for the escape?
Mm.
Probably all of it. How bad do we feel that she's being manipulated? And as she looks back on these scenes in her life later, how is that all going to feel? Because somebody who drops off a flower so that you feel better on a day when you're reminded that your father's never there for you is very different from somebody who is just always with an agenda trying to get something out of you.
That's right. I mean, I feel like it doesn't read to me like, I mean, he is getting what he needs, which is the Pugnack, right? He doesn't need
No, what he needs is for her to leave the infirmary
door.
That's the big, you know, I think he says in whatever, episode one or two, like, she's the key to this whole thing or something, you know, something like that, that like, it all comes down to, we have to escape through the infirmary.
I forgot. And it's kind of amazing that for all the tattoos and chemicals being mixed and digging and da 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 da, that it comes down to this very human, I need you to leave the door open. It's kind of great. Mm-hmm. But that's the Z, for the A to Z, that's the Z.
Like the Sucre thing. You know, like I can plan everything except who my Sally is going to be.
Right.
You know, when they did that big, like, well, can we trust
this
him?
But this is not random. This is like his master plan, which is so incredibly intricate.
Totally.
Hinges, no pun intended, on just getting this person to leave a door open.
Right. Right. And you know what I think is interesting? This is getting a little cart before the horsey, but of all the things that he never found out about her, he never found out she was an addict.
Ever? It never comes up?
I don't think so. I don't think he ever knows. Now, of course, you know, Narcotics and Alcoholics Anonymous are supposed to be exactly that. But, you know, for someone who can figure out where Otto Fibonacci is hiding, it's interesting that he kind of had that blind side.
Let's talk about the Silence of the Lambs thing, which I call it that.
I have not seen the movie, so you've got to fill me in.
Here's what happens in Silence of the Lambs.
Okay.
The FBI is closing in on the bad guy's door.
Yeah.
Right? And you see inside the bad guy has this woman locked up and it's very horrible, scary thing. And the FBI is getting closer and closer to this house. At the same time, Jodie Foster is in another town far away looking for some people that knew one of the victims, trying to narrow this down. And it cuts between these three things closer and closer and closer and closer and closer. Until finally she knocks on the door. The FBI is about to bust in this guy's door. He opens it and she's standing there. And what you realize is that they tricked you there at the, and then Scott Glenn realizes the FBI is at the wrong house and Jodie Foster's in danger. But at the same time that the audience realizes it. So it's a trick of filmmaking and it's kind of cheating in a way because they keep fooling the audience by cutting from the FBI in this house to inside the house, and it's a different house.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically what they do with Fibonacci. It's the same thing, which is like, you think you're in, these people are in location
Canada.
A, actually in location B. Yeah, they keep showing Fibonacci as these guys are getting closer and closer, and he's not there.
You know, it is a trick.
Yeah. And I think it wasn't used before then. And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe some cinephile will tell me that it was used many, many times before. But I remember at the time thinking like, that's cheating. Everybody kind of was like, that was amazing, but it's kind of cheating narratively. I think it's used all the time now.
I tend not to mind it because it's a cool moment of, oh, I didn't see that coming.
Also, I think what's effective about it is it's not just fooling the audience. It's the, like, it's also the way they fool Falzone.
For sure. For sure.
It's like what happens to Falzone, the same thing happens with the audience.
Mm-hmm. And he gets his comeuppance, which we all feel like he deserves.
Yes, that's right.
It's beautifully done. And I, like, we talked about this a little bit in the watch party, but I really, that scene where Michael and Abruzzi are talking to Falzone, I think is done really beautifully. Because as I watch that scene, my first question is, where the hell did Abruzzi get a picture of Veronica? Huh. And then you sort of think, well, maybe that's lazy writing. Maybe that's just a buy.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And then there's a payoff at the end and you realize that they were performing for each other and for Falzone. And it was super effective, but that there was one crack that felt so honest when Michael says, promise me you won't hurt him. And they cut to Abruzzi looking over at Michael with the gears turning. And then in the final scene in the jail cell, Abruzzi says to Michael, you are going to give me
Falzone.
Fibonacci.
Uh-huh.
Right? Because he realizes Michael will actually go to great lengths to protect an innocent man.
Right. And although they are allied in this situation,
they won't be
forever. They're such different people. Yes. Oh, that's really smart.
And regardless of what happens with Falzone, Abruzzi wants Fibonacci dead and will always want him dead, no matter whether or not he's in or out of prison. And so it sets up, I can't remember specifically, but I have a feeling several episodes downstream, and this is one of the things I love about the show, several episodes downstream, there'll be a fish, I don't know if I trust you about this moment.
Yeah.
Which, sure. Which I think is really cool. And, you know, three terrific actors doing really good work.
I also think that one of the fun things about this show is sometimes the audience is ahead of the characters, sometimes they're with the characters, and sometimes they're behind the characters as they are in that scene, in that dynamic, it's just so much fun to realize that they've fooled Falzone and that they fooled the audience at the same time. All right. We're going to be right back after this and we're going to get to fan questions. We'll be right back.
Yay. All right, everybody. Welcome back. Ladies, gentlemen, and fishes. Fishes one and all. Okay. Fan questions. By the way, thank you guys for sending these in. It's really fun for us to take a look at some of these. And I know we don't get to all of them. And keep the faith.
And these are from our Instagram page.
Which is?
At Prison Break Podcast. Yeah. And this is from Stephanie Reed, 4732. Sarah, do you wish there had been more scenes between Sarah and Nika?
Yes, I do.
Didn't even realize they were coming up. Right. Yes.
Yes, I do. No, I think Prison Break very rarely passes the Bechdel test. Very, very rarely.
Tell us what the
Bechdel test. I'm not sure I'm going to get this totally right, but the Bechdel test was a joke invented by a woman whose last name was Bechdel. I think she might have been a television journalist. And the joke was, can a television show or a feature film does an episode or does a feature film satisfy these three things? Are there more than one? Is there more than one female character with a name? Do they talk to each other? And do they talk about something other than a man? And, the idea is it's such a low bar
that any piece
of entertainment should be able to get over it. And it is staggering
how much
film and television does it. And I, for all my love for the show, I don't know that there's a single scene, a single episode in season one that would pass the Bechdel test. Because, of course, when Sarah and Nika talk, they talk about Michael.
Yes, I don't think there's... I mean, I think... And I can't think of any other scene that has two women in it.
Well, I mean, Sarah and Nurse Katie, but again, they're talking about Michael.
So, right. There you go. Okay.
So, you know, wow. That list... 2005, we've come a distance. But yes, I would have loved for there to be an entire episode of Sarah and Nika sitting down at a coffee shop, just going, you know, what do you see here? This is what I see here. Also, you know, teach me how to put on lipstick.
Ah.
You do, because you're really good at it. So yeah, there we go. That's that.
Yeah. Our next question comes from PB _ Misa, M-I-S-A, _ lovers. I believe that's Michael Sarah. Sarah was filming the Misa Rose scene, as sweet as it was, on screen. What a great question. That's a great question.
I'm going to tell you something about filming that scene and part of where my smile came from.
Oh, no.
Sometimes as actors, we do very silly things. I picked up the rose. I looked at it. I moved it to my face. And I realized as I was moving it to my face, Sarah, you're about to smell a paper rose.
Oh, but it seemed so natural.
Moron.
I didn't even think of that.
Of course it doesn't smell. It's a piece of paper that was made in prison.
Maybe he put perfume on it.
Let's not think too hard about what prison perfume might be. But yes, that is part of where that smile came from. Okay, I'm going to go to a Paul question.
Okay.
I Am Awkward Aaron asked Paul, how was it filming yours and Daniel Hale's first scene with Michael Gaston? I feel like we actually sort of answered that.
Like we covered that because
so
it was great.
So Awkward Aaron, I hope you feel, you know, that...
that we got to that. Yeah.
But I like this one from at Sarah and Callie's Appreciation. Can you two watch Prison Break for what it is? Or do you still quote unquote know too much and remember all the unseen stuff behind the camera? And if you were watching it as a viewer, what would your thoughts on the characters be, yourselves and each other? I'm curious, like, we're now, you know, almost halfway through season one. Are you able to watch it for what it is, or do you feel encumbered by the past?
I think that it's easier to see now than it was at the time, even though you saw it at the time. But I will also say that, it's like going to, if you're a little older, you go to your first college reunion at 5 years, and then at 10 years, if you go, part of the memories that you're experiencing are the memories of the reunion. And then you go to your 20th, and you talk about your 10th reunion and your 5th reunion and college. So it just kind of becomes layer and layer. So when I watch Prison Break now, I'm seeing the show. I'm also seeing, I remember watching this the first time it was on. I remember reaction was. I remember that feeling. I don't have that feeling anymore. I do have that feeling anymore. I think, to answer your question a little more directly, Sarah and Callie's Appreciation, is that... No, wait. That's not who asked that question.
Yeah,
sorry.
It is.
Oh.
Yeah, 6B.
Yes. Is that... Yeah, it's easier to see with some distance because I think... You know, it was one of the first things I did a lot of episodes of. I think it was the second thing I was a series regular on. That it's you're so caught up in, you know, whether you're doing your job and how you can get better that sometimes you have to get out of actor mode, and time certainly helps with that.
Mm-hmm.
But I also will say I remember enjoying the show itself so much at the time. I don't think I knew when we were shooting it how stylized and cool looking and cool sounding it would be. So it was kind of always fun to see it put together every week.
And especially like this one. I mean, I know we talked about this during the rewatch, but like I think Dwight Little shot the living daylights out of this.
Yeah, yeah. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I'm watching a different person.
Uh-huh. Like, so does that allow you to see the show as a whole?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. The distance is beautiful for me to just be like, once we get to a certain point, I will be watching it for the first time. But
you're right.
I feel like I'm watching it for the first time because I'm seeing what's there, not, I wish they'd use this take, or ooh, I really wish I'd done that differently. Like I'm just kind of taking in, for the most part, what's there. I don't, you know, lines that have changed, scenes that have cut, I don't even remember them. Which is pretty cool. Which brings us, in some ways, I think, to At Western Perspectives question. Paul, how did you like being the bad guy in season one and two compared to your eventual redemption arc?
I loved it. I didn't often get to play bad guys. And what was really fun about this particular bad guy, I liked being able to figure out how, you know, to make this person empathetic to me, not to the audience. How, you know, to get in this guy's head, which is that he believes he's doing the right thing. He's not a sadist, maybe a little bit, but a sadist with a cause. I really believed he was a patriot and that he was doing the right thing, even if he was kind of going outside the law to do it. I really enjoyed exploring that. And then just from a purely doings, as an actor teacher of mine used to say, the things that Kellerman gets to do are so fun because in almost every scene, and this is what's different about the scene with Quinn in this episode, is he gets what he wants in almost every scene that he's in. He wins almost every scene that he's in.
I mean, there is a scene with an iron in season two.
Okay. Begs to... Let's take it easy. No, that's going to be fun to watch. And I normally played characters that were super, they were either very emotional or they were damaged in some way that made them kind of hyper-reactive, which was the assignment. And in this case, I felt like it was almost the opposite of that. It was like, how steady could this person remain in the face of any obstacle? And that was so much fun to do.
That's really cool. You did it really well, too.
I really enjoyed it. And there's something about, you know, when I, one of the reasons I wanted to be an actor is because as a little kid, I loved playing cops and robbers. And you get, it's like you get to play cops and robbers.
And in some ways, you got to be both.
That's right. And run around with a badge, you know.
And run around with a badge.
It was fun.
Okay. I think that brings us to the wrap up. But before we get there.
Yes.
Remember that you can get the Watch Party episodes and hear all of these podcast episodes by subscribing to our show on Patreon. The link will be in the episode notes. And the Watch Party's fun, I hope, I think. You know, you hit play, we hit play, we watch the show together. It's kind of a throwback to like the DVD commentary kind of thing.
Yes. Sometimes we're totally engrossed in the show and sometimes we're just talking.
Like a bunch of idiots.
Yeah. Also, don't forget, we have a contest from this episode, which is send us your best answers to what is happening on the other side of Prague that makes Nika Volek only the hottest Eastern European woman on this side of Prague. Winner will be announced on our Instagram at Prison Break Podcast, and we will send you a merch mug as a prize.
And in the meantime, this, you know, is the episode where Lincoln also gets his last meal card. And there's this really touching blueberry pancakes flashback. And after the holidays, I have a new answer to my last meal wrap-up question. I don't remember what I said before, but I was in French Polynesia over the holidays. I have never been to that part of the world. And they had this food called po'e. It's not poi, P-O-I, like we have in Hawaii, and that's pounded taro. Poi is P-O apostrophe E. We call it an okina in Hawaii. I don't know what they call it in Tahiti. So it's this like pudding with like fruit and coconut milk and taro in this kind of like almost mochi consistency.
What's taro?
Taro, it's a tuber. This is where you go, it's not a tuber. Come on.
What's a tuber?
It's like a root vegetable, like a potato or a I don't know, beet rutabaga something. Yeah. So they grow them in, wetland taro is grown in like a, almost like a rice paddy kind of a situation where it's very wet and muddy. And the the leaves grow above the water, and then below the water is this, like, it kind of looks like a potato, and you mash it, but it gets really... Why are you laughing so hard? Because it's just turned into a cookie.
I'm imagining you in solitary writing this on a card. And then
Trying to explain what I want for my last meal.
And then Phil Van Leer being like, yeah, we don't have that. You
know, no, this is my plan.
This is Fox
River.
Do you want meatloaf? Do you want meatloaf? Do you want fries and a burger? We don't have poe.
Because they have to go find someone in Tahiti who knows how to make this.
Yeah.
Convince them to come.
Just kill her. Just kill her. She wants coconut milk and taro. What? I don't know. Just kill. Let's just kill her. Look at this fucking card.
This is my right.
Look at this card. Look at all this writing.
These are my rights, Paul. These are my death row rights. Anyway.
And then they couldn't kill her for 25 years because they had to find.
Exactly. You see?
She extended her life.
For all of you out there listening from death row, oof. That took a turn. Never mind.
Yes, sorry.
Okay, but if I'm put to death, papaya and mango poi for me.
Okay, I just have one more poya question. Mm-hmm. Is there savory and sweet poya, or is it more of a desserty?
There might be. I was only there for like 6 days, and so everyone I had was fruit-based and very sweet.
Sounds delicious.
You're a terrible person.
No, that was not sarcasm. That sounds delicious. Also, how long does it take to get to French Polynesia from where you live?
There was a direct flight from Seattle.
Okay.
And it was 9.5 hours long.
And it's just over ocean the whole time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, if the plane goes down, you're all going for a swim.
Yeah, I mean, you're all going down anyway if a plane goes down. But, like, I just always think about the ocean. But, like, what if there could be a landing? Like, there's no landing.
There's no landing. Although, I mean, that Alaska Airlines flight just had a door come off in the middle of the flight. And
yeah, but they were only at 10,000 feet and they're only at 16,000 feet in 10 minutes from the airport. So.
Oh, all right. Well.
And no one was sitting in those seats, which was a miracle.
Makes you rethink the aisle seats, hey?
Makes you rethink a lot of things.
Okay. That's it for us, folks.
Thank you so much for joining us. Can't wait to get into the next episode. And... remember, try not to go to prison. But if you do go to prison, Sarah.
Ask for poi as your last meal. Remember to ask for a very complicated last meal that will extend your life.
Especially on your very first day.
Prison Breaking with Sarah and Paul is a Caliber Studio production. Your hosts have been friends, but not besties, Sarah Wayne Callies and Paul Edelstein. Our prison warden has been producer Ben Haber. Our head of jailhouse rock is Paul Edelstein, who made the music for this podcast. Keeping us slim and trim, the prison yard, has been sound designer and editor, the great Jeff Schmidt. Keeping us up to date on the outside world is production assistant Drew Austin. Our prison artist, logo, and brand designer is John Nunziato and Little Big Brands. Check them out at www.littlebigbrands.com. Follow us on Instagram at Prison Break Podcast. Email us at prisonbreaking@caliber-studio.com. And call us at 401-3-PBREAK. Prison Breaking with Sarah and Paul has been a Caliber Studio production. Thank you for listening.